With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This is, well, at least for the time being, the last ever Kermode on Film podcast, and so I'm joined by Jack Howard.
Hello.
Kermode on Film's other presenter. It should have been called Kermode and Howard on Film, really, shouldn't it? In fact, maybe...
I can't believe it! What? I've got you to agree to that
now,
on the last one. The end.
But, you know...
It's always been back in goal.
Like we were saying, never say never again. Just circumstantially, we have to stop for the moment.
Are we being with the listeners?
We can be as honest as we want. What do you want to say?
Well, it's because we're having to end it because you're completely having to streamline because of this incredible new opportunity you've got with Mr. Simon Mayo.
Yes, that's sorry, that was put very corporately, yeah. Jack. I thought because you said how honest we're going to be.
It was quite corporate, wasn't it? We have to streamline. This is the thing, I don't know how, like... casually we're allowed to sort of put things, but yeah, you've just been asked to...
Well, so Mayo and I are doing carrying on doing the show that we did at Radio 5 has stopped, and we are doing a podcast at Sony, and we basically have to spend at least at the very beginning we need to just focus exactly on that. And
you're on the side of a bus.
We're on the side of a bus. So, but
Kermode and Mayo's take,
but I have to say I'm very proud of this podcast, and you know, hey, let's see whether there's a way of making it live alongside. Anyway,
it's the end of an era. Either way,
it's the end of an era. How are you feeling?
Oh, a mix of things. Very grateful for this whole thing, especially in the time that, you know, especially reflecting on it. We started in 2018, but really, I feel like it was a necessity to have this during the pandemic. I think about how often we were just doing this, because obviously for a year we weren't in the same room.
Longer than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we are. But it was a thing for a year where almost bimonthly, every couple of weeks, it was just like sitting
every
down.
Every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Bi-weekly, every couple of weeks.
Every couple of weeks I'd sit down and have a chat with you about whatever was happening or whatever we chose to pick, because nothing was really happening in the film world. Nothing new was kind of coming out. So we'd just pick whatever topic we wanted and have a chat.
Such a strange period.
And now
I
feel very grateful for all of it, but I am also, there is like a tinge of sadness to this.
Oh, I know. It's not just tinge of sadness. I mean, I'm heartbroken.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, not least because I've kind of really enjoyed people always want to say well-natured disagreements. There's sometimes not well-natured disagreements that we've had. Because, I mean, as I said, from my point of view, it's funny because I know this is a well-rehearsed story, but we met because of my child, my son, who went, "That's Jack Howard. Can you introduce me?" And I went, "Who's Jack Howard?"
And the Twitter DM, the famous Twitter DM now that I whenever people ask how I know you.
I don't know this. Do you still have it?
Oh, yeah. Somewhere. Yeah, I could search for
it. What does it say?
Okay, I'll get it up now.
I didn't know about this.
When I was working at Radio 1.
Yeah, that's right. You were at Radio 1. And here's what I remember about you and Dean had a show at Radio 1 that involved standing up.
Oh yeah, they used to make us stand up. They used to just
broadcasting standing up.
Yeah, because we were on camera. They thought it looked better, and I was like, "This is." And they had us standing next to each other when I wanted to be able to look at him.
Yeah, it was the weirdest setup.
Right. Okay. Here we are. Okay, I'm scrolling all the way back.
Is this literally the first?
This is the first, and this was bonkers for me. Okay. September 21st, 2015.
Okay.
Jack, this is Mark Kermode. A question. Do you do your Radio 1 show live or pre-recorded? Is there any chance of coming in to watch? I said, hi, Mark. We don't pre-record, we do it live. Sorry, didn't see this until we finished. Big fan, by the way. Why do you want to come watch? Be on the show if you want. Yeah, and you didn't even mention, like, but then the next one was my son is a huge fan.
Right, okay.
And introduced me to your show. I told him I was young enough once to work at Radio 1, and he laughed.
Yeah, he did, yeah. I was Radio 1's first, so it was a weird thing. Because, obviously, since the internet started, everything you ever broadcast is there forever.
Yes.
But before it, there isn't. I mean, for example, I'm doing this Radio 4 programme with Nick, who's here in the room, because Nick is the producer of Kermode on Film. And it's called Screenshot, and that's, you know, it's ongoing and it's great. And one of the things that we're doing in a show that we're about to record is about In the Cut. And I said, oh, I interviewed Jane Campion for In the Cut, you know. And there was, oh, great, what was it for? I can't remember, it was BBC, it'll be in the archive. Can we find it? Can we heckers like? I can't remember what I did it for. I remember interviewing Jane Campion and Mark Ruffalo. Nowadays, it would be, you just have to go to YouTube and Kermode, Jane Campion.
The amount of stuff you've told me as well, oh, I did this documentary, watch it on YouTube. Like, the amount of times you've told me I did this, you can find it on YouTube. And it is weird to be from the generation where I put it all on the internet. And it, like, my entire youth from when I was the age of 15.
What's the if I go to YouTube?
Yeah.
What's the earliest bit of you that would be on? Hang on, let me
Mark.
What?
Pre me being on camera. You know what the most successful thing is that I ever put on the internet?
No.
It's about to turn, I think, 15 years old.
Wow, I've got it.
Wow. That's the oldest thing of me on the internet.
I once brought some American friends of mine. They came to England and we showed them a castle, because when we were in America, they took us to a place where, and I'm not kidding, they took us by upstate New York, and there was a castle and there was a tour. They said, this is a medieval castle. It was built 78 years ago. Go on, what am I looking for? I'm on YouTube.
Type in Jack H. 1992. Jack, I can't believe H. I'm telling you listeners this. But on that channel are my first vlogs from when I was a teenager in school.
Hang on, do I search channels?
Hang on, show me what you're doing.
You search.
All right. Okay, so
this is young man shows old man.
Well, what you've done really is you've just put. It's not a bad mistake, but you've just put spaces in between everything. But my username was Jack.
Oh, I see. So I shouldn't have put space.
1992. Yes.
Oh, you're fine. Okay.
So actually, in recent years, this is quite funny. Actually, in most recent months, about 7 or 8 months ago, the channel was hacked, and I don't know how to get back into it. So there's just a bunch of like, click on this to find out how to do this thing with your iPhone videos. Like, look at the top of this. There's just loads of like spam videos that are just on my old channel. Yeah, but 14 years ago, it's about to be 15 in about a month. Is the animated Spider-Man 3 final trailer. Can you see how many views it's got underneath it?
Okay, hang on. The animated...
This is the most successful thing I've ever put on the internet.
Animated Spider-Man 3 final trailer, 4.6 million views.
I made that when I was like 15
What is it? Can I watch it?
But yeah, you can.
Has it got sound?
Yeah, the idea was... Yeah. This is how creative I was as a child. Was that I took the audio from the Spider-Man 3 trailer, and I put the animated series from the 90s on top of it to make it look like the animated series was saying the stuff from the trailer, right, and just tried to sync it up as best as I could.
I know this is great radio. I'm going to...
Just you clicking.
Yeah, hang on. Right.
Oh, here we go. This is just the actual Spider-Man 3 trailer.
I love you so much.
But this is me.
And you literally, you put old Spider-Man cartoon graphics on it.
Yeah, and synced it up. Using Windows Movie Maker. This was what I did when I was supposed to be doing my homework.
This is actually very well done, but I mean...
Right?
Wow.
Like, that is the first thing I ever put on the internet.
And you had to make the sort of the mouths vaguely sync up, so
exactly.
They seemed to be saying the same thing.
Exactly, yeah. And I had to trawl through so many episodes to try... And also, the Sandman, who was in Spider-Man 3, never appeared... in the animated TV show from the 90s, so I had to use Sandman from the 60s, who doesn't look great now, you know, years and years had gone by.
There's a comment here from 7 years ago which says, most successful thing Jack Howard ever did.
There you go. Yeah, it is the most successful thing I've ever put on the internet.
So look, since I last saw you, a couple of things have happened. One of them is that you went to see The Unbearable Weightness of
Nicolas Cage's...
No, it's not the Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent,
that's
right?
That's the one, yeah.
Which I was kind of quite excited about because I saw the trailer.
Yes.
And my daughter went to see it. She went, And then you went to see it and...
Same noise.
Why isn't it really funny?
You've seen Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, which is great.
You've seen the better version of the same idea.
Okay.
It basically starts out... I think it starts out really well... and a bit weird, and introduces you to this version of Nicolas Cage.
And so it's Nicolas Cage playing...
Nicolas Cage.
But playing a version of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, essentially he's taken on Hollywood washed-up star, and they've decided to call him Nicolas Cage, and it's an easy thing to sort of riff on. Okay. There's quite funny uses of, like, clips from his movies.
Of his actual movies?
Yeah,
fine,
yeah.
So you get to see him in Face Off. And...
like, it literally opens with a shot from Con Air.
Oh, okay.
Which is funny, and it's just like the kidnapping that happens in the movie. There's like a kidnapping subplot that happens before she gets kidnapped. She's getting stoned and watching Con Air.
Right.
So what's really quite funny is that at the end, when spoilers, it comes into a rescue mission.
If you're at the last episode of Kurt Mellon Film and you haven't realised that we do spoilers, you should probably... I'd say unsubscribe, but there's no
doesn't
point.
Doesn't matter anymore.
It's fine. Yeah, okay, go on.
Imagine if we get new subscribers from this episode. What are you doing?
Well, the archive is still there.
Yeah.
Things still go back.
Nothing
new
is going to pop up, though.
And you never know, Jack.
Yeah, never know.
You never know. You never know. Say never
come
again.
Come on, Sony.
As Sean Connery said. Anyway, so...
But when the rescue starts to happen at the end, it's obviously quite a funny idea that she was getting stoned watching Nicolas Cage, and then Nicolas Cage comes to save her. And it's not as funny as it should have been, to be honest.
That's a shame.
But what, to sum it up really, is it starts out kind of in this bromance, almost Hot Fuzz kind of way, where these two unlikely people are starting to bond over things. One of the things they bond over... is Paddington 2, which is one of the best moments in the whole film. It's great.
It's in the trailer.
It's one of the best moments in the whole film.
Okay, but it's been
spoiled. And I hadn't seen it, thankfully, before seeing the movie. And then it kind of just devolves into a boring action film with occasional silly moments, but not silly enough to be like outrageously hilarious. And it's kind of meta and pointing out the thing it's doing and thinks that's enough in order to sort of just do the cliched thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, when it ended, I said, well, it's not like it was brimming with potential. So it's not like I'm like annoyed that it didn't live up to what it could have been. It was fine. It was perfectly, you know, quite fun. But then more and more that time's gone on, I'm like, no, I am a bit annoyed.
It should have been funnier.
It should have been funnier. It should have been weirder and more outrageous.
I mean, also, since Nick Cage did Adaptation, in which, you know, he plays Charlie Kaufman and Charlie Kaufman's brother.
And there's a interesting reference to that, a motif that happens in that film.
Okay.
Kind of happens in this that I didn't see coming. And that's kind of weird, but again, yeah, there's a really funny joke in the middle with... Yeah, I'm being very vague because I don't want to spoil that one.
Yeah, because they've already spoiled the Paddington 2 joke, which is in the trailer.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, well, I'm kind of disappointed to hear that.
Yeah, I was as well.
However, I was very excited because you saw Everything Everywhere All at Once.
You got some very interesting titles this year, haven't we?
Yeah, we really have. It is Everything Everywhere All at Once. Yes.
I kept saying it all the time. Yeah, I kept going everywhere, Everything Everywhere All
the time. Yes.
But it's not that. It's all at once.
So...
It's outstanding. Are you a fan of the Daniels? Have you seen Swiss Army Man?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of course you have. You're a film critic. What the hell am I talking about?
Daniel Radcliffe came on the show to talk about Swiss Army Man. Yeah, another two, exactly, yeah. Or, you know, Farting Dead Man, as it was called. But anyway, so...
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that film was all right. I thought they were brilliant, but I think that kind of more outrageous, crude sense of humour... sometimes for me, just sort of, it went over the line to a point where I was like, oh, this is not...
With Swiss Army Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fine, but it was...
Yeah.
You know, it was nothing about it that told me filmmaking genius.
Yes,
know.
Yeah, sure. But this, I managed to see it when I was in New York because I went to New York recently to surprise my friend for his 30th birthday.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, it was really great. And I like been, we only knew that it was definitely going to happen about 3 weeks before. And I was like hiding in the bar waiting for him when he was checking in at the hotel. And I went over and I was just like, do you want any help with your bags? And he just freaked out.
Wow.
It was great. It was wonderful. But when I was there also, it was being Everything Everywhere All at Once was being shown in a, it wasn't even a wide release yet, so it was only in certain cinemas, so thankfully New York just has, you know, great cinemas everywhere.
Just briefly,
yes sir,
what is the plot? Is Everything Everywhere All at Once?
Well, to be honest, I think it is best to go into this
not knowing,
a minimal amount,
because
okay,
I've
really,
just seen the trailer, which so, just looks
right. There's a cast member in it as well that I didn't know was in it.
Okay.
And even that, I don't... I think they're sort of showing a lot at the moment because they obviously want it to be a success. And it's an indie movie. It was made for $25 million and it does not look like it.
Right.
Which sounds like a lot of money. People hear $25 million, but like what they achieve in this movie, they've essentially made at least three or four movies within a movie. But essentially, the plot is about this East Asian family... focusing specifically on the mom. She's a very normal person, just runs a laundrette. And at one point, her husband, who she's become estranged from, almost turns into a different person. Like, he almost seems like to shift his mindset and become a different human being. And it's because he has, his consciousness has been taken over by a him from a different universe. And she is being told, like Neo, you are the one. You are going to save us from a great darkness.
Okay.
And she's like, me? How could it be me? And then what happens is, and it, what's funny is that Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is about to follow this movie. And it feels like, you know how we were like, go on, follow that about Bond and all these other things. That's what this felt like when I'd seen it. It was like, oh, we're doing a multiverse movie. And that's the level we're starting at.
Okay.
I might follow that.
Okay, so I'm seeing Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness next week.
Ooh, I'm jealous.
But it opens next week.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, is it that close?
Yeah, it's like next week, yeah. So,
oh, well, then I'm no longer jealous.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm excited.
So, it's just a National Press Show check. I'm sure you can come along, you know, it's fine. So I'm seeing it, but I'm going to watch...
Everything Everywhere.
Everything
Everywhere
All at Once. First. Has that opened here yet?
No, it only just got... a release date, because it was obviously releasing in America, and all the film people on Twitter.
Oh,
were
in
like,
that case, when I
when
say
are
I'm
we
going to
see
it, I'm going to have to see whether there's a screening for it, because I would love to have seen it in it, because it just sounds to me like the two things are connected.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly, like as we've discussed on this podcast, this new wave of cinema is about multiverses, and I think it's very interesting as well, because we're kind of living in a time where it does feel to us like we're living in a weird alternate reality with like everything we had planned and everything that was supposed to happen now hasn't happened. So it kind of feels appropriate. And I think people are even quite casually using phrases like it feels like we're living in an alternate reality. So I think actually the way that cinema's kind of going in that direction feels weirdly appropriate to
although
what
I am
we've
delighted
been
to
through.
Say that on the morning that we're recording this, Macron did win.
Oh,
yeah. I mean,
right, great.
I mean, of course, everyone always now saying, well, of course, there was never any doubt that he was going to win. No.
We said that about Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. I've literally learned to never use the phrase, well, of course that's going to happen. I mean the very idea that there was even an outside possibility that, you know, Marine Le Pen could have won is terrifying.
Yeah.
She didn't.
That's not the reality we live in.
No, that's there is probably a multiverse somewhere in which, you know, extreme right wing has now run from, but brilliantly it didn't happen in the real world.
Yep.
But it is still that thing about, yeah, but it's too close for comfort. Mm. I mean, he won by a solid majority, but it's like, you don't want to win by a solid majority. You want them to be not in the race.
Yeah. You don't want it to be possible that they can even run.
Yeah, and how did it go, Benny? How did it go from, you know, what they were like 20 years ago to this is just astonishing. And anyway, but in this particular reality, that happened. Also, in this particular reality, that story in the Daily Mail really, really happened about Boris Johnson being put off by the fact that there was a woman crossing her legs. And you just go, I'm sorry, we've crossed the Rubicon or whatever it is now. Are you allowed to print that? It's just utterly misogynistic, hateful horror. But it's the Daily Mail.
Yeah, and it's Boris Johnson.
Yeah, although Boris Johnson has hotly denied it.
Sure.
You know, anyway. So anyway, but that's the particular universe that we're living in.
But this is exactly what I'm saying, though, is that like it's become to a point where actually, I mean, this is a point that they make in Everything Everywhere All at Once, where this, I think this dialogue, and I won't be quoting this directly, but it's like they say things like, doesn't it feel like something's off? Don't you just, can't you tell that something's not quite right in the world? And that obviously harkens back to probably pre this as well, but like the way that the Matrix says, like, you haven't you always felt that something in the world isn't right?
Yeah, but you know, that always reminds me of, have you ever read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I love Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because I'm a man of a certain age, and sure, everyone of my age loves Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And there's a whole thing about, did you first come across it, you know, as the radio, or did you come across it as a TV show, or mm-hmm. did you come across it as the books? All they're all sort of, you know, standalone and very individual. But the basic setup of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is that there is this really ordinary bloke called Arthur Dent. And at the beginning of the... Do you know all this anyway?
No, please.
So at the beginning of the story...
The only I think, opportunity for my generation to be reintroduced to it was the film with Martin Freeman in it.
Yeah, which
was... And I didn't see it.
Yeah, which wasn't any good, which is a shame, but you know, it's... But there we are. But, you know, here. Directly they went on to make Son of Rambo, so hey, you know. But
great movie.
It's a brilliant movie, one of my favourite movies. Anyway, so Arthur Dent... He was this bloke, you know, sort of middle English bloke, middle-aged, you know, wearing a dressing gown, whose house is about to be knocked down by the council in order to make way for a highway. And he's protesting. This is the beginning of the thing. He's protesting by lying in the road in front of the bulldozers. And his friend, his best friend, called Ford Prefect, which, Ford, you know, a Ford Prefect is a car.
Right.
Okay, fine. So anyway, his best friend called Ford Prefect says, you need to come to the pub with me because I need to tell you something very important. And Arthur says, well, have you? Yeah, I'd love to, but they're about to knock my house down. And Ford Prefect says, no, it's much more important than that. So Arthur then agrees to go to the pub. There's a thing about how they stop the bulldozers knocking his house down. And Ford Prefect says, look, you know, you always thought I was from Guildford. Or wherever it was. He says, I'm not. I'm from Betelgeuse, which is a small planet up that way. And we need to get off this planet very fast because the Earth is about to be destroyed to make space for a hyperspace bypass. So Arthur Dent, who's this bloke who just knew Ford Prefect for ages, who thought that the world was one thing, is like suddenly the next thing they're on a Vogon spaceship, and he's discovered that this bloke who was his best mate was actually a, you know, an alien visitor who just got stranded on Earth and has been, you know, waiting to hitch a lift for ages and ages and ages, but never happened. And so the whole, like, the first four or five chapters of this is just this, you know, blah, you know, one minute he's lying on the floor in front of a bulldozer, and the next minute he's out in space with all this other stuff going on. And the reason Ford Prefect is called Ford Prefect is because the guy didn't do his research properly, and he just looked up on Earth a popular name, and Ford Prefect was the name, because, like, calling himself a Ford Anglia or, you know,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
So then there's a moment about
Vauxhall Corsa.
Exactly. So there's a moment about five chapters in when Arthur Dent says, you know, this really explains something. And Ford Prefect says, what? And he says, you know, my whole life I've had this feeling that something was out of whack, that actually something was going on that I didn't know about. And this explains it. And Fort Prefect goes, oh, no, that's just paranoia. Everyone's got that.
yeah, great. Yeah.
Which I always love. It's like, no, we all feel that. It doesn't mean anything at all.
I also really like that is like an author's way of going, like, don't read into it this way.
But it's like, you know all the people who watch The Matrix and went, yeah. Yes, exactly that. Mm-hmm. Exactly. No. It's just paranoia. Everybody's got that.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So are you feeling positive about the future of cinema?
Oh, the future, I thought you were going to say. Future.
Actually, in that case, let me truncate the question because it got a better response. Are you feeling positive about the future?
You're catching me at a very interesting moment because I'm actually trying very, very hard at the moment not to go too hashtag deep on the last pod, but I'm trying so much to just be now rather than considering what could or what would be.
Okay, tell me what you mean by that.
Like, there's just the idea of being present in a moment rather than thinking about what might happen or what could happen, good or bad. I think that I can get anxious and worry a lot about what could happen or what would happen.
Yeah.
So I'm trying at the moment to just be like, all that matters right now is that I'm in a room with you having a conversation about something, and it's very easy for me to like a lot of it comes down to the stuff we've discussed that actually links very much to movies that have come out recently, like Tick, Tick, Boom. Mm-hmm. The idea of, like, am I running out of time? Am I ever going to be able to achieve that thing I want to do? Is that ever going to come to fruition? Should I quit?
Does that worry you?
Constantly.
Right.
Right now, I'm in this...
I'm going to ask you something not sarcastically for the first time. How old are you?
I just turned 30.
Okay, so Tick, Tick, Boom is particularly fine. Okay, sure.
Yeah, it was very, like when it came out, it was like guy just about to turn 30, and it came out, a few months before
I
turned 30.
Was watched by guy just about to turn 30, okay.
In a creative field, and it was, am I going to achieve the things I want to achieve,
And it starred Spider-Man, so it was kind of like, it's...
very for me. But yeah, like, I feel like I've achieved some things in my creative life that I can't actually believe I've got to do. For example, sitting here and making a podcast with you for the last few years
but the honour is all mine.
But also, like, you try and just like look at it from my perspective for a second, that I'm like just a guy who made stuff on YouTube, and then
this is turning into the end of, Four Weddings, isn't it? Just a guy
standing in front of a film critic.
It's not Four Weddings, it's the other one. It's
Notting Hill. but yeah, like, I was a guy who did stuff on YouTube as a kid. And then because your kid happened to be a fan of me, we got introduced and ended up doing a show together, which kind of, whether you like it or not, legitimized me in a way that like something else wouldn't have. Like, making stuff just on the internet, although it's gained me a following and a popularity in certain
4.3
circles.
3 million or whatever.
Well, yeah, from Spider-Man trailers. I should have just kept doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. I haven't got anything on the internet that's been watched by 4.3 million people.
Yeah, but like, even though I've done all that, a lot of the time I find that having done that sort of stuff, being labelled a YouTuber, or lately... the word is influencer.
You hate that word.
It's creepy.
Rightly
it
so.
Is one step away from manipulator, and I don't want anything to do... I think it's the word that's stuck, and it's horrible.
Yeah.
And I don't want anything to do with it, and it also boxes you in as a certain type of
person.
Is
it ever used non-derogatorily? Do people call themselves influencers?
Yeah, no, honestly.
It's
and
a thing.
There's a whole generation now who obviously have grown up with the internet always being part of their lives who want to be influencers.
But they call themselves influencers?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. Yeah. And it's a whole career now, and I don't see myself that way. I'm obviously kind of rubbing shoulders with that industry and owe a lot to it, but at the same time, I've never been shy about this, want to be a filmmaker one day. I hope I get to make something that you then review. I better hurry up.
I've just looked this up. The most viewed thing that I have ever done was the Sex and the City 2 review, which has been watched by 1.2 million. But that's a quarter of the people that watched your Spider-Man trailer. And I mean, this is what I think is kind of funny, because, firstly, there's no doubt that there are people listening to this podcast who would never have listened to it if you weren't involved in it. So I'm not just doing this. I never understood that phrase, blowing smoke up your ass.
Yeah.
You know what it means? But why... why would that be a way of, you know, somebody says, I want to say this and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. You go,
yeah, yeah.
Under what circumstance would you blow smoke up somebody's bottom?
Yeah, and why is that?
Why is that a good thing?
Yeah, yeah. Like, because it's obviously like saying, I don't know what the image means.
No, but so the thing is, so we know what it means, but we don't know why it means it. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I'm not just doing whatever that is.
Whatever that means.
But no, I mean, it's been an absolute joy for me. And it is really interesting that there are people who would listen to this because of all the stuff that you've done on the internet and because your following is much larger than mine.
That's not true.
No, but it is. And I also think it's interesting that over the course of however long we've done this for, there's been more common ground than uncommon ground. I mean, I thought at the beginning that the reason that this might work was because we're coming at it from such different perspectives that but actually there's much more common ground than you'd think.
It's fun when we disagree.
It is.
But we are actually finding a lot of the time, what I found is that a lot of the time, especially lately, probably because the world is topsy-turvy, we want to like cinema. And yeah. It's not pleasant when we don't like it.
I do think that whole thing about, I had to do an interview recently for the new Kermit and Mayo show. And the thing about rants came up. I'm not being ungrateful. I mean, I'm really not. I'm delighted that anybody, you know, would sit and watch a film critic talk for 4 minutes about anything, to be honest with you. But I do. I've always thought it's harder to praise something, and it's the thing that gets you into trouble is the things that you like, not the things that you don't like. Like, you could basically, anyone can tear anything apart,
yeah,
and get away with it. But standing up for something is a lot harder. The thing you get ridiculed for is for liking Twilight.
The joke for me at the moment is for liking Tenet as much as I do.
Right, okay, fine.
That's like, that comes up even just in, you know, with amongst friends. But I wholeheartedly stand by why I.
But isn't
enjoy
that interesting that's the thing that can get you shot down in flames? It's, you know,
going... I guess it's to do with like your taste, isn't it? That like, if that's the sort of thing that you like, how can we trust you about other things because you like this thing that universally is hated? Or
yeah, whereas you know, if you just universally hate everything, that's fine, because even if you hate things that are masterpieces, like, okay, I mean, anybody could write why The Godfather is rubbish, okay.
Sure.
Fine, it's a bunch of people talking in rooms and nothing happens and Marlon Brando's got, you know, I mean, anyone can do it.
Yes.
In fact, recently when we were having a discussion about why movies worked or didn't work, I said, look, you can do it with The Exorcist, it doesn't make any sense, and
yes,
this, that and the other and blah de blah. So anyone can, even if they actually like it. I'm reminded of the fact that when Boris Johnson was coming up to the Brexit vote, that he wrote two essays for whichever rag he was writing for, one in favour of Brexit and one not in favour of Brexit. He claimed it wasn't an opportunist ability to be able to pull one of them out of his backside at whichever, you know, but a way of, you know, considering the debate from both sides.
Prick.
Yeah, exactly. Incidentally, worked out so well.
Yeah,
I mean, it's great. Well done. Well done. I mean, just look around you. Isn't everything better? I'm so glad it all came to fruition. We have millions to spend. The NHS is in the best shape it's ever been in. You know,
I feel like we're getting away from the point.
So the point is that anyone can tear anything apart, whether they believe it or not, and you can get away with it because there's a sort of, oh, it's okay just ripping something apart. But going, I really like this, I think this is really moving, this was really charming, is the thing that will get you shot down in flames. And I always said that when I used to write on I write for The Observer, and on The Observer website, which is the Guardian website, they have a comment section underneath, right? I got them to turn them off under my review. I had a fight with them. I said, you do realise that essentially you are giving airspace to anonymous idiots. Well, no, there's a sort of debate. No, there may be a lot of debate, but you haven't got any filtering system. There are just, well, we've got people who take the stuff off of you. No, really, no. It's just people who, just, you know, abusive nonsense. And the most abusive nonsense would always come under the Twilight stuff, you know.
Right, like
Twilight. And it would just be like thousands of comments from lunatics, unhinged lunatics, about why liking Twilight made you, you know, insert derogatory adjective, derogatory, you know, noun here. And it was just, I actually started to think it gets to critics that you're more scared of standing up for something than you are of kicking the life out of something. And after a while, kicking the life out of something, it's just not that enjoyable, is it?
Do you know what, as well, because I do see myself, even though we are discussing things here, I do see myself more as a filmmaker than a film critic.
Oh, you are a filmmaker, yeah. I mean, you've made films.
And, you know, that's exactly what I'm aiming for. And the further and further I get into doing this kind of job and more stuff I get made, the more I notice that on any level, it's difficult to get it over the line and to get it made at all with all the voices that happen, even on the level. So the most recent thing I made, I mentioned it a few months ago now. I don't think it's come up since. The most recent thing I made was for Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a title last time. We just called it Jack's on named Jack Comedy Central thing. It's called East Mode.
Okay.
It's an East Asian sketch show. And I treated every single sketch like a different genre. And so there's the horror one, there's a heist one, there's lots of different sort of ones. I even, as well, did one that took place in a restaurant where the gag is that the food in the restaurant is so good that the two women almost have orgasms when they're eating it. And the other one's like, what the hell just happened to you? But in that sketch, I reference Ratatouille, you know, the moment when he goes into the synesthesia. Yeah. I got the actual animator to do the animation from Ratatouille on my spoof parody reference homage to Ratatouille. I remember messaging him and being like, would you want to do this? And he was like, I wouldn't want anyone else to do it. And so that was just this amazing thing that ended up happening. Oh. But my point
I love that scene in Ratatouille.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes him back to his innocent childhood.
I mean the moment when he experiences what's called synesthesia. So all of it sort of goes dark and then you have all the shapes popping off around him. Do you remember this scene that I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. We're talking about two different scenes. Fine, okay,
yes.
Fine. Yes,
but
okay.
That's the scene I'm talking about. Is when he notices what it's like when he puts cheese with strawberry
or something like that.
Yeah. I got a load of great insight from him about how he and Michael Giacchino, who did the score, like influenced each other's work, basically, because he was animating to the music and then he would change the music based on the animation and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But my point being is that the further and further I go down into this job and doing that job, which was sketches for Comedy Central, so it's not like it's like huge stakes and like wasn't an immense amount of money, but still, even at that level, the amount of voices that were involved in it, the amount of like versions that had to get made, it makes it so much clearer to me that when you criticise something and say, like, you know, I criticised Last Night in Soho and the book stops with Edgar Wright because he's putting his name on it, but I'm not talking about it and being like, well, this is entirely down to the way he intended it to happen. Like, who knows how many voices were in the room for a film of that level? When we talk about Marvel, imagine making something for the mouse. Like, the amount of stuff, the amount of approvals, that people criticise the way that Marvel movies look because they all have a similar palette. When I see Doctor Strange, I'm going to be looking for like a sprinkle of Sam Raimi. I hope that he manages to get through a bit in order to be able to like feel like he was involved. But I won't be surprised if he has got to a stage in his filmmaking career after making Spider-Man 3 and then Oz the Great and Powerful and basically disappearing from directing, because he probably couldn't take probably the backlash and things. I can't even imagine what he went through. Same with actually Mark Webb, who made the amazing Spider-Man movies, kind of backed off a bit and is now coming back and is directing the Snow White movie. I imagine that, I mean, they're great case studies with Rachel Zegler. And I imagine those two filmmakers came back to big budget filmmaking a bit more like, I know how to do this now. Like, I know the game I'm playing. I bet there was more of a fight before, especially with Mark Webb having made indie movies like 500 Days of Summer and then going to the big budget Spider-Man. And we all know as well how much Sony meddled with those films. But it's kind of like that's the game you're getting into. So when you criticise something like that, it must, like, the filmmaker as well, like, must be like, oh, God, like, it must be so hard to sort of see people going in at stuff like that you also know is like not the way that you wanted it to happen. But do you know what I mean? Do you know what I'm trying to get at? I'm scratching at it, but I don't think I'm getting to the meat of it.
It's always been that, you know, I remember saying to somebody once, why is it that these great big franchise movies get in second time directors?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, you'll do Monsters and then the next thing you're doing a Godzilla movie, or you'll do a kind of weird little time traveling art movie and the next thing you're
Jurassic Park.
Exactly. I said, why is that? And the person I was asking said, well, so they can beat them up. You know, it's because they've got no power. That's the point. I went, oh, okay, fine. Well, that I hadn't thought about. But it's also, there's something also slightly beyond that, which is that the behemoth is the behemoth. The machine is making itself. It will produce a tank-like thing at the end of it. And what they want is just the little sprinkle, just the little bit of, and it always takes me back to that, you know, we've all got that Barton Fink feeling, but since you are Barton Fink, I guess you've got it in spades, right? You know, it is just, they just want a little bit of that Barton Fink feeling.
Yeah.
But they are still at the end of the day making an ocean liner of a thing, and it is going, you know, the engine's going to be in this place, and that's how the ship is going to be aligned.
Hearing Val Kilmer talk about being Batman, he was like, oh, I'm basically just being like wheeled around facing the right way. Say that, you know, he was talking about being part of this huge machine, and that it's not like he's not delivering anything other than just basically like he's just like the face of Batman. Yeah. He's just operating the machine of Batman.
Yeah. Although Val Kilmer, I mean, it's, you know,
yeah,
I'd feel sorry for him, but no. But that thing about it's the combination of. They can't fight because they're not big, but they have a little bit of something that you'd like, and also they bring on board perhaps, you know, the art house critics. Oh yes, this is interesting because it's directed by insert name of director who made film that no one saw that I'm interested in.
Yes,
but Raimi is always an interesting case because The Evil Dead was the film that, you know, that changed it was the classic video nasty, although actually it got acquitted at Snaresbrook, but it was the film in the early 80s that, you know, Stephen King, you know, called it the most ferocious horror film he'd ever seen, and it was the Obscene Publications Act, and, you know, my God, it's the most terrifying thing. But I remember seeing The Evil Dead and people going, oh my word, this is, I can't believe how full on this film is. And they had literally made that from money that they borrowed from local dentists.
Yeah.
All of whom, incidentally, have now got fabulous big practices because of all the money they made out of The Evil Dead. But Raimi always seemed to me to be that guy playing in the sandbox. You know, he always seemed to, even when he was doing the Spider-Man movies, it was like, I mean, I remember I went back to my review of Spider-Man 2 for The Observer. And I remember saying, it is astonishing that the guy who made The Evil Dead, which was going to bring about the end of civilization, is now making these family blockbusters on a scale that nobody could possibly have imagined before. But I think he is, was, and will always be Sam Raimi. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, let's see.
And that's you know, it's the same. I think actually Sam Raimi and then someone like even Christopher Nolan, who obviously made Following as basically like almost like a student film almost. He made it over the course of a year over weekends. But then Memento was his first like studio film, which is still tiny, and then was hired obviously to do Insomnia.
Which is a before, remake.
Before doing Batman, that even feels a little bit like small indie director getting to operate this huge machinery. And obviously he put so much of his voice, the way that Raimi put so much of his voice into Spider-Man, he put so much of his voice into Batman, which I think also kind of kept that trend going of hire these like auteur directors to operate our huge superhero movies. And now you just get to say from Academy Award winning director Chloe Zhao,
a film which you would not know was directed by Chloe Zhao
except
unless...
for all the shots that are pointing towards the sunset.
Okay,
she loves that. But
not,
this is what
it's
I'm
not
saying
good, is it though,
is that I wonder how much of Sam Raimi is going to come through in the Doctor Strange, or whether or not, and I wouldn't blame him, he's relaxed and just gone, I'll play your game,
I'll just do the job,
I'm going to come and play the game, I'll you get to pay me a lot of money, my name's in the trailer for people who care. And I wonder whether or not I'll just like move the camera like this instead of like doing it the way they think to do it, but I won't actually be able to inject what I think this film should be.
Raimi will always have a special place in my heart, because when I was starting out in film journalism, I went to America to go and get some interviews, because, you know, the only way you could get stuff printed was you had the jump on everybody else. So I went and stayed with my friend Tim Polcat in Los Angeles, and I just rang people. I faxed maybe their offices and said, look, I'm a journalist, I'm trying to get some films to blah, 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 can I? And the people who gave me interviews, and I was nobody, I had written a couple of reviews for Time Out, that was it. Wes Craven gave me an hour of his time. Linda Blair gave me 2 hours of her time. And Sam Raimi invited me to come and interview him at his offices at Universal.
Oh, wow.
When he was making Darkman.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was astonishing. It was just like, it was him and Bob Tappert, and I think they gave me the best part of 2 hours. And it was, I mean, really, really nice. Really, really lovely. And I said, look, obviously I haven't seen Dark Man yet because, you know, he's still making it. But what's the key difference between Dark Man and, you know, and all the other stuff he made? He said, well, look, this is a much more kind of grown-up movie because it's about this character who, you know, he loses his face, then he becomes other faces. And he shows, it's really, it's kind of to do with the character and to do with Liam Neeson. So one of the things I'm really going to do is I'm going to keep the camera steady. I'm going to, like, sandbag the camera down. Oh great, you know, you see the film, camera's flying all over the place. It's like there may be one moment when it comes to rest, but it's like that was so, I'm going to really, really, because obviously in the case of Evil Dead it's on a piece of wood doing that, you know, that weird thing all the whole time. But I just remember sitting in his office, it was in that big tower, and thinking, why are you even bothering to give me your time? And how lovely that you did. Anyway, then I wrote it up for Dark Side. I might have used it for Fangoria. I got back in touch with them and said, oh, you know, I've done the front cover feature for this UK publication, you know, great, fabulous. And also, I think it was somebody like Fango wanted, you know, is it all right if I take it to them? They wrote back and said, I can't believe you even bothered to ask. How very nice. Yes, go ahead. You know, it was, because, you know, it was snail mail as well. It wasn't, we didn't email them or anything. But he was really, really lovely and really...
I think it's amazing when you find out that, like, people of that calibre are interested in, like, giving their time to somebody who's just interested.
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like I'm at the start of my, whatever this career ends up being, I'm at the start of my directing career, and I'm reaching out to directors that I admire who work in television and things like that. Like, a guy called Ben Taylor, who directed a great series for Channel 4 called Catastrophe, and he now is basically the showrunner and head director for Netflix's show Sex Education. And I reached out to him, and he has been nothing but lovely to me, and he doesn't need to be. And that, like, just the idea that I'm just some guy who's been like, hey man, I'd like to talk to you and get some tips and like maybe ask for a bit of advice or maybe even come and shadow you on set. And he's like, yeah, like, cool. And just being very generous with the opportunity is just something I didn't kind of expect.
But that's, you know, that's always the case. When I started... When I came, it always sounds like a poke scene, when I first came to London, the three people who took me under their wings were Nigel Floyd, Alan Jones and Kim Newman. And they basically showed me the ropes. And I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for the fact that they had looked after me. Nigel, I met in the offices of Time Out, and we literally, like, looked at each other across a crowded room, and that was it. But it was... It was,
time stopped.
Yeah. No, I mean...
It was like that scene in The Worst Person in the World.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. I ran all the way across town. Everyone was standing still. We had a fabulous day together. We went to the park. We fed the ducks. I came back and my old boyfriend was still in the same place where I'd left him. But, you know, they didn't do that. It wasn't for their benefit. They did it because what they all said was, well, somebody took us on, and then, you know, when James King was at Radio 1, James King was sort of initially kind of in inverted commas understudy, although it's ridiculous because, I mean, he was much better and much better looking, you know, very soon became my replacement, and good for him. And then he's done the same thing, and, you know, and it, because you saw... simply because everyone remembers somebody else doing it to them. So yeah. I know this is now sounding terribly bland, isn't it? But
well, no, I think it's nice to know it exists.
In what you think of as cutthroat professions, it's astonishing how much there is a lot of, you know, let me help you.
Yeah.
And from people who, I mean, I didn't know those people. They had nothing invested in giving me their time, nothing at all. But they just thought, okay, well, you know, we will do and thanks very much, which has always been great. And actually, of course, I've carried on working with, I mean, you know, Kim was the lead writer on Secrets of Cinema. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nigel and I have been best friends forever. And Alan Jones, whose name comes up many times on this podcast, is, of course, now running Fright Fest, which is incredibly successful, and is actually now become, you know, an international festival director. Incidentally, I must mention this, something which happened since I last saw you on the subject of good things that are going on in the world. So, you know, the Cinema Museum in London, where we filmed Secrets of Cinema, for ages and ages has been fighting this campaign to save the Cinema Museum. So this was just recently announced After 15 years of campaigning, the Cinema Museum's future looks bright. At last, we have a chance to secure a permanent home for the museum and saved a well-loved unique heritage building, the Lambeth Workhouse, which was once the home of Charlie Chaplin. We are thrilled. We can't wait to buy it, mend it, and share it with those who love cinema, film, creativity, architecture, stories, memories, and all the good that comes from positive social change, pro-environmental behaviour, and caring communities. So, they have signed a 4-year lease with their landlords, with an option to purchase the Masters House building for $1 million at any time over the next 4 years. It said that might not seem much to raise in 4 years, but the buildings need many millions spending on them. So they've got 4 years to raise quite a lot of money. But this is great. The Amazing. Cinema Museum has been holding out to save the Cinema Museum for years and years, to the point that it almost became called Save the Cinema Museum as opposed to just the cinema. There was a guy, when I was at college, there was a guy called I think his name was Nicholson, Jamie Nicholson, but he was referred to as Free Jamie Nicholson because Free Jamie Nicholson was arrested once on a picket, because we'd spent most of the life smashing the state, and he was arrested on a picket, and we immediately formed a campaign, Free Jamie Nicholson. By the time the paperwork of the campaign had gone through, he was out. He literally wasn't in long enough to be freed. But also some people industriously went around spray painting Free Jamie Nicholson. So Jamie Nicholson then just became referred to forever after as Free Jamie Nicholson. So like Save the Cinema Museum was almost like its name. But now the Cinema Museum...
Well, that's
Museum
very cool,
saved,
though, isn't
that
it?
Great?
Yeah, incredible.
It's a good news story in a miserable news cycle.
Little things like that. Occasionally, just like they do, sort of. I'm just glad that things like that, that people care enough still that for stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like even Nick as well. Like
Nick is here in the room.
Nick is here in the room. Quiet. Producer Nick, who's basically the third member of Kermit. He's always in the room.
Always in the room,
like a hawk. But like even Nick, like having got the Acton,
the Act One Cinema
in Acton, like, which is like my local that I still go to, even though I've moved away slightly now, but having heard about that for years and getting that done, like, just, it's just amazing, man. Like, it's just cool stuff like that happening. And yeah, I think it's just nice to know that people want to give their time, energy, and sometimes money to that sort of stuff, especially in times where it feels like everyone's kind of keeping hold of theirs just in case. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of like dragons sitting on gold.
Dragons sitting on gold. You really did grow up on fantasy movies, didn't you? but also because you said earlier on, trying to live in the moment, which of course is almost the most impossible thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds so easy, live in the moment, and yet you go, okay, try it.
Yeah.
You can manage it for a second. If you can manage it for any tiny period of time, I mean, I know people meditate and study for ages to be able to live in the moment, because all the time there's other things going
gotta
on.
Gotta do that, gotta email that person, gotta do this. Yeah, yeah. And just even just like a little worry, man, that like, what if none of this works out? Like, just like my brain, just like, why is my brain being mean to itself?
But this is, in a weird way, you and I are very similar like this, because I mean, we had a kind of heart-to-heart about it a few months ago.
Off mic, so it basically didn't happen. There's no proof.
Yeah, no. But I can refer to it as having, is that, I'm racked with anxiety and guilt and fear most of the time. And everything else kind of pushes it to one side. But I live in the permanent expectation of utter disaster. And I don't say that like, please feel sorry for me, I'm a neurotic. I don't want any sympathy for it. It's just a description of a state of mind that is actually not that uncommon.
But yes, exactly. I think that's why it's important to talk about. Not because you specifically are looking for sympathy, but just like saying, hey, this is normal. This is a normal thing that people feel all the time.
Yeah. And that relates back to the... No, that's just paranoia. Everyone's got that,
Honestly, a mutual friend of ours, Hazel Hayes, who is an author and a writer and things like that.
Very successful author.
She did very well. She once, a few years ago, interviewed Steven Spielberg, and everybody in the room, like there was a room of people who were selected to come and have a chat with Spielberg and Tom Hanks, and everyone in the room got a chance to ask a question. And Hazel asked the idea of, does the feeling that what you've made is good enough ever go away? She asked that to Steven Spielberg.
The worry that it isn't good enough.
Once you've made it, like, is it ever the thing you thought it would be in your head? And he was like, That never, it will never go away, and it doesn't go away. And even when stuff comes up on telly for him now, he's like, oh, I have to skip past that.
Yeah,
can't watch that, or that's not the way I wanted it to be. And we've even talked about how he doesn't like Hook, and I think Hook's great, and it's got a real special place in my heart.
And it turns out loads of people think it's great.
But the major point being, if Steven Spielberg doesn't think that his stuff is good enough, you could look at it pessimistically and go, well, what hope do any of us have? But really, it's just like, well, that's a normal thing to think about the things you make.
Yeah.
He is arguably the greatest filmmaker still alive, who's made some of the greatest films of all time, and he doesn't think he's good enough. And clearly that's just something that all of us are racked with, no matter what your focuses are, be it filmmaking or whatever in the world, that we're all racked with, like, oh, I'm quite capable enough of doing this thing.
David Letterman, apparently, who I just love Letterman, when he left the building every day, whichever building they recorded the, you know, late, whichever David Letterman, as he went out, he'd say to the doorman, I'll be better tomorrow.
Wow.
Like, to the end of his career, that was his same thing. And again, it's like, well, you could see that as depressing, or you can see it as just the fact that it's just completely normal.
Yeah.
It's completely... I mean, I also...
It's hard, though.
No, it is hard, but I, you know, my greatest worry in the world is that I let everyone down. Is that I'm not asking you to say, you know, I'm not literally pitching you a softball.
I literally have seen this happen. Like, it was a few weeks ago when we were scheduled to do a podcast, and...
Oh, yeah, and I blew it.
I just completely forgot.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, like, a big deal to me. It was like, you acknowledged it, you apologised, we moved on, but I saw in you, like, this spiraling of, like, oh, I've completely messed this up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I saw it happen in action.
Yeah, and I mean, that's my standards. And, you know, I'm very lucky. I've got, you know, I've got a lovely family, God bless, and I've got lovely friends, and, you know, and my greatest fear is that I will let all of them down.
Mm.
And I think that, again, that's probably much more common than anybody cares to imagine, because... I mean, you know, recently there's been a lot of talk about mental health issues, and it's a lot more publicly spoken about issue. But I think a lot of people wrestle with this stuff all the time. Like you said, when you're talking about it, you're not talking about it like, please give me sympathy and feel sorry for me. It's just like, no, it's just, it is part of the modern malaise.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any way of, you know, when you're talking about that thing about living in the moment, making the noise go away for a while. I've always sort of liked it because both you and I are in therapy.
Yes, yes.
And the analogy I always use is the moment of silence, the making the noise go away. And I will say this, and we need to sort of bring this to a close because we've been talking for ages, but at its best, cinema has always done that for me.
Honestly, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, why do you think both you and I like going to the cinema? Like, why do you think that is? It's exactly that. It's that for a moment, for a few hours, none of it exists.
Yeah.
It's just you in that dark room with the thing. It's why I like going back. You know, a lot of people find it weird that you could watch the same thing over and over again.
Oh, no, I love that.
I love doing it. I love, because I'm, the more I get to know it, the more I'm involved in that world and that thing and whatever. And yeah, like, it is just like a healthy coping mechanism, I think. It's a thing that I enjoy, that soothes me for a second.
And maybe that is, at its best, an example of that thing that you're talking about, of existing in the moment. I mean, I always felt it about horror films, because when you are scared in the cinema, you are alive and you are aware of being alive. You know, you are aware of that moment that you are in right then, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems odd to sort of compare that with silence, but it is a moment of sublime obliteration of everything. I mean, you can think of it as Petit Mort or something, but it's just the moment that everything else goes away, and that's the thing that you're focused on. And when cinema does it, I mean, horror cinema works particularly for me, but when any cinema does it, it's a sort of transcendent thing. But it's also, and what the opposite of transcendent, endant, you know, it's also that you feel the blood in your veins.
I think that's what happens when you feel like you've seen a movie that has truly captivated you, is that you come away being like, wow, was that, it was that long, and it's over. Like, you know, I've seen films sometimes where I didn't see the ending coming, and especially the further and further I've gotten into like understanding structure and, you know, all these other things that you start to notice and cliches that come up in cinema, you can kind of see the rhythm as it's happening. But when you come away from a movie, and that's how I felt about Everything Everywhere All at Once, was I came away being like, whoa, I was there, I was in it, yes, the whole time. And I wasn't aware of, like, I was in New York and in the cinema next to you, and I didn't know. I was just taken by that. So I think you're right. That's that's when you feel truly moved by a film, I think it has made you forget that it was a film, almost. Yeah. Like, it made you totally present.
Yeah. Well, look, that seems like the perfect place to bring this to a close.
We have to close it. And I think that's what I'm doing, is I'm elongating, because I'm like, no, it can't be the,
Lord
can't
of the
be
Rings,
end.
Return of the King. Bye. Yeah. Bye. Bye.
Just forgot this.
Bye.
Actually...
I just said that bit. Well, look, I mean, I don't want to jinx anything.
Sure.
All right? But
you feel pretty confident there.
I'm to quote Only Fools and Horses.
Oh, go on.
No, it's not goodbye, as they say in France. It's bonjour.
No. it's funny that you say that as well. When I made my last YouTube video about 7 or 8 months ago, which was me being like, I'm leaving for a bit, not forever. This is exactly what I did. I quoted that exact thing.
Of all the things have in common, it turns out to be Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah.
Well, love you, Jack.
Love you too, man. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, hasn't it?
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening as well. Like, what a cool lot you are, sitting here and listening to us have a ramble with each other. We decided to do this because we chatted in pubs after things, and we're like, well, people would want to listen to this, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they did that. This is a podcast.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, it's what's it that they say what's the film that won the best picture? Nomadland.
Sure.
I never say goodbye. I say, I'll see you down the road.
Yeah.
Because I will.
Keep watching the skies, Mark.
Keep watching the skies.
So long, partner. Oh, hey, Buzz, you have been my mommy's toys.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.